In his book 13 Years After, Will Bird, a Canadian, wrote of a visit to La Boisselle in 1932. He said this: "It's a tiny village. A few heroic ones have tried to reclaim that wilderness, but only the main street and another lane or so have resulted. All else are craters, shell holes, gullies, rifts in the earth, barren in spots of anything that grows." The following year, the famous writer Vera Brittain, she visited the Lochnagar crater. She said the craters are now becoming overgrown with coarse grass and all gradually, although very slowly, filling up as the earth silts down into them in rainy seasons. Homely hens now peck peacefully around them and placid cows crip the gruff grass at the edge. The chauffeur pointed out the hump of earth 3/4 of a mile back where the shaft was let down for the tunnel to the mine. It was started 3 months before July the 1st by coal miners from Northumberland and Durham. And much earlier than that, a year after the Greathead push of the 1st of July 1916, there was a painter called William Orpen. He came across one of those great mines at La Boisselle. He was touring the battlefield making sketches and paintings, and he described the crater as a wonderful sight and a great wilderness of white chalk without a tuft of grass, no flowers, nothing but blazing chalk dotted thickly all over with bits of shrapnel. He walked up to the edge of the crater and he felt himself to be in another world. All of these three people are talking about the famous village of La Boisselle on the Roman road that goes from Albert to Bapaume. This was the scene of such savage fighting on the worst day in the history of the British Army, the 1st of July 1916, the first day of the Battle of the Somme. Yes, we're back on that date. We'll never run out of stories to tell about that infamous day in history. And this week's podcast, the I, Terry Wenuncle Tales from the Battlefields, was recorded, like some of the others we've done recently, live on the battlefield, when I was joined by a man called Martin Talbot, who's a school teacher and a historian from the Northeast himself. And he has, as we're going to find out today, a particular passion in researching the men from his part of the country that suffered so much on that hot summer's day 110 years ago now. So let's now go over to the battlefield and discover so many stories of those boys who left behind such an incredible legacy.
Because I'm part of a very select group of people who've been on the podcast twice.
You have? Yeah, congratulations.
So I teach in Teesside, and I teach sixth form, and that's history and law.
Yeah. You've got a particular interest in the Northumberland Fusiliers that were part of the 34th Division on that day.
Yes.
And it's their story that we're going to follow today. There's four battalions, was it?
For those people who don't know, divisions are the building blocks of the army, and they contained 12 infantry battalions, and of those are three brigades. There are two brigades that are from the northeast.
Two whole brigades.
So yeah. People always talk about the problem of recruiting and recruiting from the same area being, you know, PALS battalions. Well, PALS battalions were never the problem. It was the fact that they were often, it was when they were put together in battalions with, in the brigade, with other PALS battalions from the same area.
Yeah.
So we've got the Tyneside Scottish, which is four battalions, yeah. Tyneside Irish, four battalions, and then also the Pioneers of the 34th Division. They were also not on the Fusiliers. So that's nine battalions.
And they're all here.
They're all here.
Yeah. Either side of this main Roman road runs dead straight, Roman Road, where we're standing. On the right-hand side, as we look towards Bapaume, towards the east, on the right-hand side is the southern part of the battlefield. And then when we go look to the other side, onto the northern part of the battlefield, your battalions are either side. They're astride this road, aren't they?
Yes, and the road is the most important part of the battle, because without it, the battle will come to nothing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. But as always, more has happened before the Battle of the Somme in 1916, and I've got a couple of accounts here of what it was like in 1915.
Yeah, this is talking about the winter of 1915. A man called Charles Dewey, who is serving with the 1st Dorsets, still, he's in the 32nd Division here then. And he said, we passed down our frontline trench towards the ruins of a cemetery. And just over there, we can see, we talk about cemeteries on the Somme. This is a civilian cemetery that was there before and is still there now. He's talking about a civilian cemetery just on the north side of the road. East of the cemetery was the heaped white Mind the Glory Hole, which we're going to see in a minute, just round the corner. Above them lay the shattered tree stumps and the litter of brick, which had once been the village of La Boisselle. There's no village there now. We progressed slowly down the remains of the trench. We came to the craters and the saps which ran between them. Here there was no trench, only sandbags, one layer thick and about 2 feet above the top of the all-prevailing mud. The correct posture to adopt in such circumstances is difficult to determine. We, at any rate, were not correct in our judgment, as we attracted the unwelcome attentions of a sniper, because the German trenches are quite close here. They're a long way apart on Mash Valley on the other side of the road, but here, as we'll see when we go around the corner, they're very close together. And this sniper's well-aimed shots experienced no difficulty in passing through the sandbags, so the sandbags only give them partial protection. We crawled away and came in time to a trench behind the cemetery known as Gowrie Street. Liquid slime washed over and above our knees. Tree trunks, riven into strange shapes, lay over and alongside the trench. The wintry day threw a greyness over all. The shattered crosses of that cemetery down there lay at every angle about the torn graves, while one cross, still erect by some miracle, overlooked the craters and the ruins of La Boisselle. The trenches were alive with men, with no sign of life appeared over the surface of the ground. You wouldn't, would you? Even the grass was withered by the fumes of high explosive. Dead, indeed, was the Emperor here. Before, this is months before the battle has even began. We are standing here by a memorial bench.
Well, when it talks about the trustees of the Joseph Cowan Fund, the Cowan family in Tyneside had been manufacturers of bricks.
Yeah.
And there are a number of family members who are confusingly all called Joseph, so it makes it very, very confusing. But in 1914, when the battalions were being raised, there was no War Office approval at the time, and that was one of the key problems about raising all of these battalions. So he gave £10,000, which is somewhere in the equivalent of £1 million nowadays, and that was to raise the Tyneside Scottish, Tyneside Irish, and the Commercials, in the expectation that they would each raise a battalion. Tyneside Scottish raised 4 service and reserve battalions. It's the same for the Tyneside Irish as well. So, and then in 1922, Marshal Foch came and led this. And I'll provide you with a number of pictures of that opening. But right. Yeah, but there are people from Tyneside and French soldiers and Marshal Foch who come to open this. And what's really quite stark about it is it's quite overgrown. It's quite green right now. But back then, it was still...
There's nothing here.
There's nothing
here. It hadn't been rebuilt. This is the 20th of April, 1922.
Not only is nothing being built, there's nothing really in the village very much. You know, they're still rebuilding the village. Mm. And then this is one of the first things that gets put there. This is, I believe, the first permanent regimental memorial on the Somme.
Right.
So, you know, this is before... There's plenty of wooden things, but nothing permanent. So this is one of the very, very first... memorials. There are a few other memorials that do appear before it, but this is the first regimental one.
Mm. And we're looking back, we're on the front line here, but as we look back on either side of the road, we're in a valley and there are 2 steep hills on either side of the road. Do you want to talk about those now?
Yeah, so those steep hills, the Tara Usna line, they offered protection, particularly to the Tyneside Irish who were coming in behind the Tyneside Scottish. They would attack behind them in later waves. And as soon as they came up on the horizon there, they would have become visible. Not to the men in the front line, but men all the way over in the other side of the valley. So they would have been hitting them from, you know, hundreds and hundreds of yards away.
And there's a famous photo, isn't there? The Northumberland Fusiliers on the other side of the ridge. but just they're holding their rifles, and as they go over that, they're silhouetted against the horizon. They're in ideal machine gun range from the men, the Germans, that are in Ovillers village, the ruins of it, and Le Boisselle, about 1,000 yards across their ideal machine gun. And you can see now where we're standing, we've got the, what are they called? The rapeseed, is it?
Rapeseed.
Wildflowers that are in the field. But just imagine, we can see the figures. If you came across that horizon, because they're supposed to come through the trenches, but the trenches are clogged, aren't they?
Yeah.
With the dead, the dying, wounded trying to get back. So they have to come across the open ground and they're cut down, aren't they?
A lot of people will ask, you know, well, can you hit something at that sort of range with a machine gun? And a machine gun is not supposed to be accurate. It creates what we call a beaten zone.
It's not aiming directly at the men, is it?
It's not aiming directly at men, so it creates a beaten zone which will lay rounds at, you know, different points in this beaten zone, and that will create, it suppresses that area.
It's a hail of lead that's going, I know people can't see it on the podcast, but going like this, the machine guns are going like that, making this, you know, almost impossible to get through, as those boys up there found out.
Yeah.
Great. What's next? So we're going to talk about the time size. Who were these men? Because to me that sounds a bit confusing. When we say that they're Tynesiders, we think of the North East, but then we're saying they're Scottish. Tyneside Scottish. What does that actually mean?
The name is it's a bit of a misnomer, because we think about Powell's battalions. They're not really Powell's battalions, because they're not actually Tynesiders for the vast majority of them. They're actually from all over. It goes all the way down through the Durham coal fields as well. And then later on in the war, they would actually recruit further afield from that. So,
but these men that are here, would they be volunteers then?
Yeah, they're all volunteers. They are possibly former soldiers, but also we've got men who've come from the shipyards, men who come from the coal fields, also as well clerks and whatnot.
Yeah.
But then the officers are sort of people who work in, say, the chemical industry. They work as lawyers, they work as teachers, they work, you know, we've got one who's a maths tutor, we've got one who, yeah, really sort of, you know, quite an array. We've got an architect as well.
What about the commanding officers of the battalion?
I know, this is the interesting part, because, and this is what, you know, people who really get into the First World War, they always talk about British Army doctrine, they want to talk about that. Well, there are four battalion commanders, and three of those four battalion commanders who were there just before the 1st of July, three of those four are what we call dugouts. They're retired, they've come from the Indian Army, or they've been...
Professional soldiers.
But, you know, some of them have retired, I think one of them had retired back in 1907, so any of this idea of the lessons learned from the Boer War hadn't really been implemented. So the soldiers that they're training are really fit, and they're really well disciplined. So the soldiers that come over, they don't come over until January 1916, and some of them have been, you know, they've been in since October 1914.
So they've done a lot of training.
They've done a lot of training, so they're very.
Haven't been anywhere else.
When they came here, they went to the Bois Grenier sector, and then it was very, very quiet. And then they came here in about May time, 1916.
Right. So they haven't been to Gallipoli or anywhere.
No, nothing like that. So they're well trained, they're well disciplined, they're fit, but they are not sort of trained in sort of up-to-date tactics, you know.
It's, right. So 34th Division, I know we're going to concentrate on just four battalions, the Tyneside Scottish, but the division has got a commanding officer, like they all do, and it's a famous character, Major General Edward Ingeval Williams. What's his nickname?
It's Inky Bill.
Bill, very famous character. And as you said, there's three brigades. The Le Boisselle, the German bastion here, was defended by the 110th RIR. What's that stands for? Royal Infantry Reserve or something, isn't it? 28th Reserve Division, anyway. The village, there was only 35 houses in Le Boisselle in 1914, and was part of the mining community which flourished here before the war, and was obviously a key objective. The village had been under German occupation for 2 years, and during that time they constructed these strong defences and very deep dugouts, using the cellars of the houses. They were secure and comfortable shelters, many being fitted. Would you believe they had electric lighting down there? Some of these dugouts were 30 feet deep and connected by a labyrinth of tunnels, and all this had been achieved by the Germans in 2 years here without the British or the French really knowing anything about it. The defences that skirted the perimeter of Le Boisselle, where we are now, formed a salient that extended towards the British line, with an apex only 100 yards away from the British trenches. Laubwassel was positioned on this spur with Mash Valley behind us, to the north in Sausage, because if you've got a Sausage Valley, which is behind us to the south, of course, on the other side of the road, you've got to have a Mash Valley, haven't you? They've got to be, you can't have one without the other. So this was a formidable position, with German machine gunners hidden behind sandbags in the ruins of the village that had been devastated. So any full frontal advance, either from the flanks or across Mash Valley, would meet very strong opposition. That's what they were to discover. And there was lots of mutually supporting redoubts and strong points up where Lochnagar Crater is now, that linked in with the village, the sister village of Ovillay, which is on the other side of the road. Gives us an idea of what they were up against. This was a major task, which of course the artillery bombardment was going to mean that all these defences would have been taken out, weren't they? That's what was going to happen. Right, this is a German account of what it was like to be underneath that bombardment. Trenches and obstacles, weak dugouts, and even the best observation posts were almost all destroyed. On the 29th of June, von Wiggenhoff, great German name, was buried in his battle headquarters and suffered gas poisoning. However, he remained in command and was transferred to a reserve battalion headquarters in Contelmase, so he's gone back. Movement in the trenches was maintained only under the most extreme exertion, and their original course was hardly recognisable at times. So the artillery has smashed the trenches, but not, of course, the deep dugout. So the German defences have taken a battering, but they're underground. The men are underground. Across the road, we're going to go into Mash Valley by that civilian cemetery that we talked about. Let's see if we can get across the road without getting killed.
Yeah.
We're now standing on the edge of Mash Valley, looking across, which we talked about with the 8th Division attacking across Mash Valley, and that was the neighbouring division, wasn't it, to the 34th. But this is all about the 34th Division, and we're standing right by that cemetery, the civilian cemetery, looking out across Mash Valley with Laubwassel on our right. And again, we've got some accounts here of what it was like when they went over the top in this area. And this one, an unnamed witness of the 2nd Middlesex Regiment, watched the 4th Tyneside Scottish attack. So this chap who's written this is on the other side of Mash Valley, looking down to where we are here. And he says this: "The pluckiest thing I ever saw was a piper of the Tyneside Scottish playing his company over the parapet in the attack on the German trenches near Albert. The Tynesiders were on our right, and as their officers gave the signal to advance, I saw the piper, I think he was the pipe major, jump out of the trench and march straight over no man's land towards the German trenches." This is exactly where we're standing now. "The tremendous rattle of machine gun and rifle fire, which the enemy at once opened on us, and completely drowned the sound of the pipes. How he escaped death, I cannot understand, for the ground was literally ploughed up by the hail of bullets. But he seemed to bear a charmed life, and the last glimpse I had of him, as we too dashed out, showed him still marching erect, playing furiously, and quite regardless of the flying bullets and the men that were dropping around him." And they think that that man was Pipe Major John Wilson of the 1st Tyneside Scottish.
Yeah.
And he was awarded the Military Medal for conspicuous bravery and devotion to duty. But there was another piper, Garnet Wolseley Fife.
Aggie Fife.
He was not so fortunate. Yeah.
Yes.
He was killed as they went across no man's land here.
I mean, there's a lot of soldiers' humour about this sort of thing when they mention about the, you know, the pipers and those. So you've got in Mash Valley, you've got the 20th or the 1st Tyneside Scottish, and you've got the 23rd, which is the 4th Tyneside Scottish, attacking together. And there's an account where one soldier, as the pipers are playing, recounts that either he or the piper, Aggie Fife, has been hit in the arse. That's what he
really?
Said. I've been hit in the arse. And the response comes back, "Haven't we all?"
Right.
You know, and it's just, you know, that soldier's humour that even in this sort of, these sort of moments, they can still think about making jokes about
that's
that.
That's blokes, isn't it?
Yeah.
Changing room. In football, we call that changing room banter.
Exactly.
Even at the worst. This is what keeps them going. Private Tom Easton turned out to be a very famous man, didn't he? He was serving with the 2nd Tyneside Scottish, and he's on the other side of the road.
Yeah.
We're on the northern side, he's just on the south.
And he said, well, at the 0 hour came, the great mine was exploded at 7:28. And he took that Rockstar crater, shaking the very earth on which we stood and throwing into the air thousands of tons of earth. When this has settled, the whistles blew and we clambered into the open and began our advance, keeping in line an extended order. Which to me sounds like, you know, you're a fair guy. Men began to fall one by one. One officer said we were okay, because all the machine guns were firing over our heads. This was until we passed our own front line and started to cross no man's land. The trench machine guns began the slaughter from the Les Boisselles salient. Men fell on every side, screaming with the severity of their wounds. Those who were unwounded dare not attend to them. We must press on regardless. That's what they were told. Don't worry about the wounded men. Hundreds lay on the German barbed wire, which was not all destroyed, and their bodies formed a bridge for others to pass over into the German front line. They're using their own dead as bridges to get across. When we got to the German trench, we'd lost all our officers. They were all dead. There was no question of wounded. About 25 of us made it there, he said. He survived to tell the story of the day. And there's one more here. Corporal Robert Kennedy of the 4th Tyneside Irish, rather than a Scottish, advancing across no man's land, he said in a letter to his wife, "Over the top with the best of luck," was the cry. So over we went, only to meet a perfect storm of machine gun fire. Then our lads began to fall. The first mine to fall was a chum on our left side called Nicholson from Ellison Street in Gateshead. Then my bosom pal, Sergeant Hall. After that, my memory was not very clear. I was seeing blood until I was thick of it in the German line.
Some of the accounts in Mash Valley particularly really, really quite... The officers were fearless and they led from the front. And in one account, they have one of the commanding officers leading from that very, very front. So the four battalion commanders... ...for the cop on the 1st of July in the Tyneside Scottish, every single one of them is killed.
Yeah.
Which... I don't know how that compares, but if you look at, the Tyneside Irish, one of theirs is killed and two are injured, which is very, very high.
They're leading from the front.
They're absolutely...
Here, where we're standing, here.
Yeah.
They're leading from the front with a cane.
Yeah. Now, I believe you've been reading about this. This was Lieutenant Colonel Lyle.
Yes. Yes.
He was the one who had the cane.
When we come to Lyle, if people are listening to this and they go in their kitchen and open the cupboard, they'll find some treacle in there, perhaps. Or some granulated sugar, and it will come from Tate and Lyle, who made sugar. And this man comes from that family, doesn't he? He was one of the founder members of that company.
Yeah, so he does come from that family. So even though, you know, we think about, you know, that people who were, you know, were rich would somehow get out of it. No, he
didn't need to be here, did he?
No, well, he's 40. Yeah. Which is relatively young, actually, for a commanding officer. He's 40, and the other commanding officers are in their 50s.
Yeah.
One of the commanding officers is invalided out just before the attack, and a 43-year-old takes over.
Right.
So, you know, we're still talking about quite older officers.
Yep.
By the end of the war, you know, we're talking, you know, senior officers who were in their... You know, late 20s, early 30s, yeah. And so it's very, very different. But Colonel Lyle, he goes over the top.
Where is he? Is he this side of the road or the other?
He's this side
of
the road.
He's in Mash Valley. Where we're standing.
Yeah, this is happening. So this initial part closest to the road, to the junction, is where Colonel Sillery's battalion goes. And then the one that has further is Colonel Lyle's. His is the 23rd.
Right, so it's just a few yards away from where we're looking.
Yeah, so we have... you'd have the Keats and the...
Keats Redan.
Exactly. And that's where they would have attacked from.
Yeah.
And they were attacking to the area which was where the YSAP crater would have been, which is still noticeable.
You can see it clearly on some of the aerial photographs after it's been filled in. And that's gone up at 7:28 on top of this German redoubt. But again, it hasn't really helped them, has it?
Well, the idea of these mines is it would just bite off the nose of... Strong points in redoubts, which is fine. However, the one major lesson that we learn from the first few days of the Battle of the Somme is that the German army do not in the whole keep most of their troops in the front lines.
No.
They keep them just further back because if, you know, there's an emergency somewhere, they need to move troops about. So
yeah.
So we learn very quickly, actually, don't shell the very front line, shell just behind it.
Right.
Yeah.
What's happened to those two commanding officers here then?
So, well, there are various accounts. I'm sure you've got an account of what happens to Colonel Lyle, but they are both killed here.
Right.
And their bodies are discovered by none other than Major General
Inky Bill,
Ingleville Williams.
Immediately.
No, not immediately. It's a good few days later that they're found.
13 days later, I think. They've got to wait. Then, obviously, their attack fails on that day miserably. And it's another 2 weeks, almost, before they take Bladwell and Ovillay. And it's only then can they start to clear the battlefield. And he comes walking across here, doesn't he? And he finds those bodies of commanding officers and other men as well.
Which I don't think is too strange, because somebody like Ingleville Williams, you get the impression that he does know his officers.
Mm.
You know, he will recognise...
He wanted to go and find them, and he would recognise their
bodies. He would recognise, you know, he would have recognised other officers as well.
Yeah.
But he did actually end up writing a letter home to Colonel Sillery of the 20th Battalion's wife.
Wife, yeah.
Yeah, and he says it might be some small consolation how much I regret loss. He died splendidly leading his men, and that was to the admiration of everyone. But that was both Colonel Sillery and Colonel Lyle who were leading their men well. It was really, you know, quite...
I read one account, I don't know which one it was, but one of them, he's got a pistol in one hand, he's got his stick in the other, a shell was taken off his arm, one arm, and with the other arm, he's got his stick and he's telling the men to come on. And as he does so, he's riddled with bullets.
Yes. This happens actually a few times. There's a few accounts of officers who, in some accounts, you hear that they've been hit by artillery, and in other accounts, they've been hit in the head and killed outright.
Mm. Yeah.
And I'm not sure whether they've been killed and then hit by artillery afterwards,
yeah.
Or whether they are just being, family are just being told that they're being killed instantly because, you know, that's the thing
kind
that people...
Thing to do.
The kind of thing
and
to
also, see. A machine gun bullet could take off an arm as well, couldn't it?
It might
be artillery. But this is where they've died. No matter how, what happened, this is where they've led their men into attack in this field, where we're standing, and this is where they've died, and this is where their commanding officer, Inky Bill, who himself... is killed just a few weeks later, isn't he?
Yeah, he's killed at the end of July, close to Mametz Wood, and that in itself is an intriguing tale as to why he was there, what he was doing there.
Yeah.
Very, very interesting.
What he was doing that close to the front line when they're supposed to be miles behind, we believe, when we watch Blackadder, these boys are miles
behind.
Yes. They're not. They're here. They die here.
Absolutely.
So, with those two commanding officers then, they do have graves because he's found them.
Yes, so they're taken back to Bapham Post Military Cemetery, and they are side by side. So if you do get a chance to visit there, it's definitely worthwhile going to see them. And you'll see countless other members of the Tyneside Scottish there, and some Tyneside Irish. But also the other side of Mash Valley, Villers Military Cemetery has a lot of Tyneside Scottish and Tyneside Irish there.
Right, let's move on then. Let's go and walk through the village, shall we?
And as I recall it, on the Tiapo War Memorial, there are six 16-year-olds listed there.
Right.
One of whom is also in Mash Valley.
Really?
May still be in Mash Valley.
Yes, yes.
Who was a young lad from Whitley Bay called Randall Bennion.
Yeah.
Who lied about his age and by all accounts did look a good bit older.
Yeah, yeah.
He lied about his age when he was 15, got in. And this was his, you know, first
day in action.
Yes, and it's, you know, you've got that complete contrast. People who are at one end who are very young, and at another end who are a good bit...
Well, we've got nearly 40 years then, haven't we? Between a 54-year-old lieutenant commander, lieutenant colonel, and a 16-year-old private.
Yeah.
Both go into action in the same place and both end up losing their lives. One at the beginning of his life, one halfway through.
Now, what's really interesting as well, one of the things that I always try to get across is people think that everyone back home is sad on the 1st of July.
Well, they don't know about it, do they?
They don't know about it. And in fact, they don't know about it for a good while afterwards either. You know, so they might have known that there was some attack going on. But some of those men, for instance, Randall Bennion, who I was talking about, it was August before his mother found out he was missing.
Missing. She must have wondered, because she hadn't heard from him.
Well, exactly. But, you know, there's an expectation that perhaps he could have been taken prisoner, or, you know, the Red Cross would find out information that way. But it wasn't until February of 1917 that that she was told he's dead. And even then, with no grave, you know, so there's... So you could see how people could hold on to hope that...
That's right.
...that maybe one day...
None of those 72,000 men on the Teat Vale Memorial, none of their families had any closure.
Yes.
You know, it's one thing thinking that your loved one has died in battle and not been able to see their grave, even though they've got one, because it's too far away. But it's another thing knowing that he's just missing, presumed dead. You know, it doesn't just give you any information, does it? Now walking up through the village of Labwassel, and as we walk up the hill, on our right is what's called the Glory Hole, which is an area of no man's land that wasn't actually attacked on the first day of July 1916. And when we look at it now, we can see why, because it's still got very deep mine craters in there and the remains of some trenches as well. And the trenches here, we're standing where the German position was, and just like, I don't know, 30 yards away would have been the British positions. And it was the decision, when we look at the trench maps now, we can see these craters that had been here since 1914, late 1914, hadn't they? They started mining under each other here. And it would have been impossible for the Northumberland Fusiliers or anyone else to get across here quickly and on top of the Germans, because they've had to go down into these craters and then up again. So they didn't attack here, did they?
No, and this section of the trench was held by the 18th Battalion of the Northumberland Fusiliers, the pioneers who were... So there's even more north... Actually, in this very, very small area of the battlefield, there are all nine of those battalions are all here in some way, shape or form.
Can you see, Matthew, this is... You know, you asked me earlier about when did they start mining under each other. Well, this is when the French held this village and they're fighting with the Germans. And there was a farm here, and they fought over this farm for weeks and weeks and weeks. The farm was then destroyed. Then, this is when both sides have now started. These aren't shell craters, these are mine craters. Smaller mine craters than what we'll see elsewhere. But this is where mine warfare started, long before the British got here. This is from sort of December 1914 going into the early months of 1915. So that's the Glory Hole, which I mentioned is owned by a local French family. It was open to the public probably 10 years ago now, but it isn't now. There has been some archaeological work done there by a group, but I think there's all sorts of legal issues as to why it's no longer open to the public. But you can still see it from the main road, and there is an information board here as well. With some wonderful photographs on. It tells us that the Glory Hole, situated on the edge of the village, was the site of fierce fighting during the First World War. It's one of the rare vestiges of mine warfare, and its present appearance is the result of 110 mine explosions being set off by the French, British and German mining engineers. The French troops contained the German advance on Albert and Amiens here as early as September 1914. Fighting was immediately concentrated on the Glory Hole, where there stood a farm which was gradually destroyed by successive attacks from either side. The French abandoned Labwassel, the village, on 28 September 1914. They then recaptured the farm. The Germans called it the Grantoff. Christmas Eve, they captured it here. They didn't get any further. The Germans had turned the village into that fortress, which was only broken when, in the early weeks of July, 2 years later. And I said that the no man's land was narrow here, and it tells us that less than 30 metres separated the enemy trenches, and it was one of the most dangerous places on either side, anywhere on the Western Front. On either side, men lived in constant fear of mortar, grenade and sniper fire. And on the French side, soldiers from everywhere were recruited to dig the trenches, and the site became known to the French as the Eylot, I think that says. And then there's lots more information there. It says again on the 1st of July 1916, they didn't attack here because it was too impossible to pass across. So we now walk up through the village. Incredible to think, the account told us that, you know, there was only about 30 houses here. It's much bigger than that now.
And as it's been rebuilt as well, and this road is called the Street of the 34th Division.
Yeah, of course it is, yes.
Yeah. But now it's all been rebuilt. It's hard to imagine that this was actually part of the German trench network that we're walking through now.
Yeah.
So, you had trenches running parallel and perpendicular to the various roads, and they were the various lines. And we can't really be sure how far some of the Northumberland Fusiliers got into this system. There are accounts that that they got maybe into the second or the third line. And
because they have made progress. Everybody thinks that in this area that everyone got slaughtered in no man's land. They didn't. There's lots of accounts of the Northumberland Fusiliers getting into the German trenches and beyond.
Yes, yeah. There's certainly Tyneside Scottish and Tyneside Irish, potentially as far as Contal Maison,
which is probably 3 miles, maybe 2 or 3 miles.
I don't think it's that far, but it's certainly. But it's
the next village, isn't it?
It is, and it's remarkable to think that they would have got that far. But the problem is that
they're
isolated groups. Yeah, they're cut off, and that they were buried by some of the airmen who were flying over at the beginning of on the 1st of July.
So you can see them.
Yeah.
And then we cross the road, which says Le Grand Mine, pointing us towards what we know as the Loch na Garr crater. French call it the Grand Mine. Yeah. We continue on the road up the hill.
Can I just go back to the story of Randall Bennion?
Yes, tell us more about this 16-year-old lad.
So he's a 16-year-old boy. A lot of regiments in the army, we hear stories about young boy soldiers. He's joined at the age of 15 and he's killed at the age of 16. But when his mother finds out, she continues throughout her life to put messages and obituaries in the local newspaper.
Okay.
Yeah, and this is one that I got from 1918 when I did a bit of research on it. And if people are interested in this, there's an excellent website and project called Northumbria World War One. It's got the databases of so many soldiers, and one of them is Randall Bennion. And it says, "When alone in my sorrow, bitter tears often flow. There stealeth sweet dreams of a short time ago. Unknown to the world, he stands by my side and whispers, 'Dear mother, death cannot divide.' Ever remembered by his mother."
Oh, wow.
So, you know, we always think about, you know, the actual death on the Somme, but actually the pain, once
it never goes away.
It's the pain of those people who are left back home.
Yeah.
Now, he's one of three siblings, and he's got counts of the half-siblings as well, so it's really quite difficult.
Mm. Such an interesting subject, which I love researching, is, you know, what happened to the families after the war. You know, what happened to mum?
Yeah.
How did she rebuild her life? Did she ever rebuild her life? Did she die with a broken heart? You know, and all these sort of things. It's the legacy, the social history of the Great War, isn't it?
Mm. Now, I would sort of direct listeners of the podcast to, there's an excellent book by John Sheen and Graham Stewart just called The Tyneside Scottish.
Yeah.
It's reprinted now by...
this is a book.
Yeah, Pen and Sword.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's really, it is, if you want to find out more, it is the most important book on the subject. And in it, one of the accounts that they find is of a soldier who was killed, and the soldier had three children. So the wife promptly remarries a soldier widower,
right,
who has three children.
Right, so she's now got six.
And then...
has more.
Yeah, well, then the new husband is killed as well.
Oh, no.
So she's left with six children.
Three of which aren't hers.
Three of which aren't hers. And she, you know, to be able to care for them all,
with no money.
Yes.
Small pension.
Small pension, yeah. So it's...
And as we now approach the centre of the village, I can see the rebuilt church in front of us. But on our left, which we must mention, all these villages have got these, is the French memorial. It's the French soldiers from here in La Boisselle that fell. Not necessarily here, but all over France. They're remembered on the war memorial. And we've got a French soldier, the Poulou, I think they call him, the Poulou. And he's standing there with his upturned rifle, his French rifle. His hands are clasped together against the barrel of the rifle, and he's looking with that unmistakable French moustache, like a musketeer, isn't he, really?
Yes.
In his face, that look in his face, and he's looking down the road that we've just walked up. He's got his putties and his overcoat. He's got his ammunition pouches there, and that's a fairly determined but sad look in his face, I would say. But it's important that we pay our respects to the French memorial in La Boisselle. Quiet now, isn't it, as we get towards the back end of the village.
We're going towards the memorial that a lot of people miss. It's just got a new sign.
Is that a new sign?
That's it? A new sign for it, yeah.
Right, excellent.
So hopefully more people will visit it, but it's often neglected, this one.
Matt, there's something here to show you. We were talking about recycling, the farmers recycle. See the picket fences, the silent pickets that the farmers use? They were an invention that saved hundreds of thousands of lives. Because before they used those, they were using wooden stakes. Mm. Going out to them and banging them in. As soon as they did that, made a noise and no more wiring party. And then someone had the idea of using those, which is effectively a big corkscrew. You put your piece of wood through the top and turn it. It's a silent picket. So now, as we get to the southern end of the village, we go uphill, the road towards Contalmaison. Before we leave the village, there's a new green sign which looks a little bit like the signs that point us towards the Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemeteries, but it's not asking us to do that. It's asking us to turn left to follow the grass path towards the 34th Division Memorial. And that's where we can have a look at some more accounts of the aftermath of the battle, because I think this is where, as the battle moved on and their commanding officer has been killed, this is where they set up the headquarters, didn't they? Battalion divisional headquarters. Very quiet now as we make our way away from the road. All people can hear has been passing vehicles, and as we do so, the sound of vehicles is replaced by the sound of birdsong, which we've been hearing all day. Been hardly a breath of wind today.
And it's something which we don't appreciate now, I think, about the birdsong.
I've started to as I've got older. It's strange, isn't it? I understand nature more so. Yeah. Beautiful memorial, white Portland stone. And it says, to the glory of God and in memory of the heroic dead, this monument is erected to commemorate the illustrious deeds of the 34th British Division near this spot on the 1st of July 1916, the first battle in which the division was engaged. And then when we look up, what am I looking at?
We're looking at a bronze...
How would you describe that?
A bronze sculpture of Victory.
Right. That's not a soldier, that's a woman.
Yes. She's holding laurel
wreaths.
Well, she was, but she's not anymore.
The laurel wreath has long... Because when we look at the photos, which I'll put on the podcast page of my website, we can see the men from the Cambridgeshires, I think, were here, weren't they?
Yes, they were the Suffolk Regiment. Yeah, the Cambridgeshires, yeah.
They were part of that division as well. And when they're here, and we can see them in the photograph all around the base of the memorial, and when they're looking up, she's clearly holding a laurel wreath, but it's gone, long gone, isn't it?
It has. You've also got the insignia of the 34th Division there, which is the checkerboard.
That looks like a chessboard.
Yeah, exactly, and that was the divisional flash.
Ah, right.
Now, also as well, Loch Na Garr, you're actually wearing one of the badges for Loch Na Garr.
Yep.
That has the same sort of motif.
Oh, yeah, so it does, yeah. I wonder what that was. Yeah, there's a Loch Na Garr crater foundation. Every crater has got a foundation attached to it, and Loch Na Garr is no different. It's a nice enamel badge, red, and in the back is in the front of it, in the middle of it, rather, is that insignia of the Northumberland, of the division. Division,
yeah,
isn't it?
Absolutely.
Of the division.
Yeah. Now, the picture you're talking about, it's of a 34th Division reunion in 1936.
Right.
Now, from what I can tell, it is just the men from the Suffolk.
Yeah.
But these sort of old regimental associations, there don't seem to be as many for the Tyneside, the Scottish and Tyneside Irish. There is one for the Tyneside Scottish. People can join, and if and I think it's for the 23rd Battalion, and I think you can join if you've been in any one of the battalions. But yeah, it's you just don't get that same, you know, sort of old comrades club.
I mean, they've gone home to get on with their work, rebuild their lives, and it's been a struggle for them, hasn't it?
It has.
These boys that are here, Turnham, and he says it became evident that the attack had pressed on without avail. Officers and men had been literally mown down, but in rapidly diminishing numbers, they had resolutely pushed on to meet their deaths close to the enemy's wire. No man's land was reported to be heaped with dead. It was impossible to estimate at all accurately the extent of our losses, but steps were taken to ascertain from the advanced dressing stations the names of the wounded officers and the number of men dealt with. On the 3rd of July, Brigadier General Turnham crossed No Man's Land to visit Major Acklam. Here he witnessed the enormity of the tragedy that had occurred 2 days previously, as he passed through successive lines of dead Tyneside Scots, lying as regular as if on parade. They lined up in lines, and they were cut down in lots. The 102nd Brigade, Tyneside Scottish, had, to all intents and purposes, ceased to exist, with 940 killed and 1,500 wounded. 80 officers went over the top, and only 10 survived. What remained of the 4th Tyneside Scottish were collected and mustered at 900 hours on the 2nd behind the Tara Usna line for roll call. Only 100 men answered their names. 20 others turned up later.
Yeah. So, you know, people were... When we talk about the first day of the Battle of the Somme, people always think 1st of July. But there are some soldiers who were out here until the 2nd, 3rd of July.
Of course.
Because they're cut off, or they're...
They couldn't get back.
They couldn't get back, or they're, you know, so... Now, when I was looking at a few of the, you know, the casualties that which lost 317 killed.
What would they have started off with?
Now, 1,007 is the standard.
Yeah, they wouldn't have had that.
They wouldn't have had that. So, possibly 800.
Right. Yeah. So they've lost 300 and...
317 killed.
Killed.
267 wounded. Now, when I looked at that, I thought that was wrong.
Right.
There's no way...
Seems too much.
Yeah. Yeah,
too many.
Yeah, so, and it's not, you know,
it's
I looked it back over and it's... Yes, that was the 20th Battalion that lost that many. And actually the numbers have been revised slightly, and that's 337 killed and 268 wounded. So they actually had a casualties of 631.
Out of about 800.
Probably.
Maybe a bit
yeah,
more.
Yeah. Yeah, but this is the 23rd Battalion, the other battalion in Mash Valley, don't lose quite as many wounded.
Our stretcher bearers were... This is another another soldier's account, doesn't actually say who he is, doesn't matter. Our stretcher bearers were conspicuous by their daring in bringing in wounded men in daylight under fire. These are the boys you're just talking about.
Yeah.
The dressing station and the trenches near were soon congested with casualties, and only by continual and very exhausting work by Captain Muirhead, our medical officer, and his staff were they able to gradually relieve this pressure, which was not until the following day. During the course of the day, 20 more men turned up. All these men were sent into dugouts to rest until the evening, when they were formed up into parties for carrying rations and ammunition to our attacking troops. The only two officers who turned up for the roll call were Lieutenant Shelson and Second Lieutenant Daggett, who were very exhausted and had a most harrowing time.
Now,
tell us more.
Now, 2nd Lieutenant Daggett...
I've heard his name mentioned.
You will have heard his name mentioned, because 2nd Lieutenant Daggett, he was in the 23rd Battalion.
Yeah.
He was in Air Company. Air Company was commanded by 2nd Lieutenant Joseph Cuby, who was from South Shields. He was killed, having gone, the reports say, not more than 100 yards.
Yeah.
Daggett, by the end of the year, was the company commander.
Really?
He'd only just joined them in, I believe it was March of that year. So he was the company commander. He was a captain.
Yeah.
By the end of the year, by the New Year's honours list, 1917, he'd won the Military Cross for trench raiding, right?
Yeah.
And then in February 1917, he just disappeared. He just disappeared in a trench raid. And presumed dead, and you know, and his name was put onto the Plug Street Memorial to the Missing, which is just on the Franco-Belgian border.
Yeah.
And then, do you know David Tattersfield?
The Western Front Association.
Western Front Association, yeah. He's one of the... one of the vice chairs
there.
He did some research when he saw some graves together, and he managed to, through research, identify that this unknown grave to an officer of the Northumberland Fusiliers was actually
Daggett.
Where
is he then?
Cedric Daggett is he's right near Armentières, just outside of Armentières.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so, and do you know what's even more amazing about that? Is Joseph Barclay Cuby, Cedric Daggett, and then an officer who was killed and who has no known grave near the Loch Na Garr crater, were all visitors and members of the Literary and Philosophical Society of Newcastle upon Tyne.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, you've got that
link. All those connections.
You know, so all of these connections. So, you know, these professional men, you know, they would have, you know, known each other in Civilian Street, and then, you know, they're... Here they are.
It says that the Brigadier delighted with the fine performance and bravery shown by the battalion. But in this book, his Pen and Sword book, written by Michael Stedman, Batlab Wessel, he says in the quiet darkness of their recollections, it is impossible to imagine how these men felt. The survivors.
Yeah.
Not the men that are dead, the survivors. Later on, the moment is of isolated bands of men, some moving on to Condell Mason, later taking part in the defence of Shelter Wood, which is what we covered in our previous podcast, and the fighting around Scott's Redoubt. Other small groups fought with Major Acklam, falling back south of Levoisel. By late evening, three officers and about 80 men belonging to the 25th Battalion were back in the British lines at Keats Redoubt, just north of the road where we were just now, having returned from their abortive attack across Mass Valley. From right to left of the 34th Division frontage, it was apparent by nightfall that the Tyneside Irish and Scottish were little more than an utterly spent force. Rawlinson's decision to utilise the inflexible tactics of the parade ground in the Great Bush had proven to be catastrophic judgment, especially here at Levoisel.
Yeah.
With hindsight.
Yeah. Now, what I would say about that is that, you know, the commanding officers of those battalions are retired. You know, the men are, whilst they are not capable of fighting any other battle.
It's a very steep learning curve, a tremendous human cost. But that's all they knew at that stage. This is what I meant by when I said there, people criticising Rawlinson and Haig. That's hindsight. You have to see Rawlinson and Haig at that time with the resources you've got available. The lack of technology, so you don't know what's going on, and you don't know what's gone on until a few days later. Certainly don't know what's gone on the 1st of July. And people then said to me, well, they should stop then, the battle on the 1st of July. Well, how could they do that politically as well, when the idea of this battle is to relieve, one of the objectives is to relieve the pressure on the French down at Verdun. And how could Haig go to the British cabinet, who we reported to, and say, oh, actually, we're going to stop this?
We know now there's about 19,000 killed on the first day.
Yeah.
Haig doesn't quite know that number at the end of the first day. And when we say the end of the first day, maybe within the first few days, he's thinking a few thousand initially and then possibly 10,000. So that, you know, the numbers aren't exactly clear straight away how many have been lost.
No.
And it, very
we good. Know now, and we're looking back at it with 110 years of hindsight and information and research and academic study, and that's an advantage to us that they didn't have. And I think, and I don't know about you, you know, I'm not a professional historian, I don't understand all of this, and I'm sure they got a lot of things wrong. Of course they did, but they also got a lot of things right.
And what's noticeable if you look at, say, the letters, is actually the men commending their officers, leading them over the top. They knew no fear, one of them says.
Yeah.
What I would do say as well, as we're sort of crossing the area close to the road to the Loch Nidar crater. I mentioned there one of the officers who would have known Daggett.
Yeah.
And that was John McFarlane Charlton. Now, John McFarlane Charlton's father was a war artist.
Right.
And his brother was also a member of the Northumberland Fusiliers, and it had gone off to Ypres with a territorial force unit. And he'd been killed on the 24th of June, 1916.
Right.
And his father had begun to make the arrangements for a memorial service, and he puts a note in the local newspaper saying that there's going to be a memorial service and that his brother is currently serving in northern France.
Right.
By which time that's published.
Okay.
He's dead as well, so both brothers die within a week of each other. Now, John McFarlane Charlton, by all accounts, we have it from the account of somebody called Captain Herries, manages to get through the first line, the second line, and something happens with his machine gun that probably jams, and he's killed just before the third line. So they get, you know, they get a good distance. Herries ends up surviving the war, but John McFarlane Charlton, he has no known grave.
Yeah.
He has no known grave, and so when his brother is buried in Ypres and the Commonwealth headstone is put there, it actually mentions his brother. Yes.
Right. So, anything else to add before we sign off?
Well, could I mention that Loch Nagar,
yeah,
there was, in 1998, there was a body found at Loch Nagar.
Oh, yeah. Cool. Famous body.
Within 2 years, it was identified as Private George Nugent, and he had disappeared. He'd been a railway worker, had been working at the goods yard in Newcastle, and he'd been identified through his cutthroat razor,
yeah,
which was found on his
engraved his name on.
Exactly. Yeah. And and the author of the Tyneside Scottish book was actually approached about this, and he quite flatly said, if his cutthroat razor is there, it's very unlikely to be anyone else but him.
It's too private, isn't it? It's too personal.
You know, it's not something that someone would swap. It's not something that someone would, you know, take from another.
Yeah.
So
there's a wooden cross at the crater now, isn't there?
There's a wooden cross, and
so he's got his own grave now.
He's got his own grave at Villers.
Yeah. And they traced his family, didn't they?
They did.
They traced his family. He was buried in the year 2000 on the 1st of July. Is that
yeah, right? Exactly. 84 years later. So, which is a testament to what the War Graves Commission and the other groups do in trying to identify it. They're still identifying remains, and they're still, you know, if people are interested in it and they do enough research and they present it to the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, like David Tattersfield had done with Daggett, those bodies, those graves will be rededicated.
Yeah.
And they do it all very properly. They get members of those regiments.
Yeah. Nugent, his cutthroat razor, his medals and other stuff they found on his body is on display in the museum in Newcastle, is that right?
Yes, yeah, the Discovery Museum in Newcastle. Again, that's free to go and see anyone's at that way.
Yeah, great. Well, that's a good note to end on, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
So a massive thank you there to Martin for telling the story of some of the Northumberland Fusiliers. And one thing when I was listening to it back and editing it that caught my attention was that story of Captain Daggett. And he mentioned that David Tattersfield, the vice chairman of the Western Front Association, had carried out some research into the death of Captain Daggett. So I went on the website and I discovered an article that he'd written about it. He said that it was on the 19th of March 2024 that relatives of men who served in the 4th Battalion of the Tyneside Scottish came together for the first time at the Commonwealth War Graves Commission Cemetery that Martin mentioned near the French-Belgian border, and it's Rue Petillon British Cemetery. And they were able to stand over their ancestors' graves and pay their respects. An official report tells us that Cedric Daggett was last seen on the lip of a German trench during a raid. There was an official report, and it says this: Second Lieutenant Milloy, together with Private Dillon, dropped into the enemy trench again and proceeded to the right. He, Milloy, again returned to Captain Daggett and noticed two of the enemy standing on top of the parapet firing very lights. Shortly after this, three of her men were seen leaving the front line, being pursued by a strong party of Germans. Captain Daggett and Milloy then rushed to the wire and commenced to clear their wounded men. This work was proceeded with until the enemy bombs began to drop on this party. Captain Daggett, taking in the situation, ordered everyone to jump clear of the wire and said, "Everyone for himself." On Second Lieutenant Milloy turning round, he discovered Captain Daggett and Private Dillon nowhere near him. As Martin said, he'd simply disappeared. And that was on the 11th of February 1917. Daggett and some of the other men that were killed were buried by the Germans some miles behind the German lines near Lille. Another men that took part in the raid were killed, were then recovered by the British when the Germans withdrew from this area, and their bodies were recognised and buried in a British cemetery behind their own lines. But back in the 1920s, when all this happened, the Imperial War Graves Commission, as it was then, reinterred the dozen men who'd originally been buried by the Germans at Rupetilon as part of this concentration process. These burials were carried out rather hastily, and virtually all of these men were unidentified apart from their date of death, that 11th of February 1917. One was buried as an unknown officer on his headstone. He was probably partly identified from the cut of his uniform. And it was all those years later, 107 years later, that that unknown officer was identified as Captain Daggett. And at the end of the ceremony, of course, the last post was played. And fittingly and rather emotionally, I imagine, the service ended with a piper playing the Highland Laddie, which was the regimental march of the Tyneside Scottish. And I think it's only appropriate that we end today's podcast doing exactly the same thing. In memory of Captain Daggett and all those other Northumberland Fusiliers, and in particular the Tyneside Scottish, that were killed, wounded or missing on the 1st of July 1916.